So 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Last week we started looking at the second paragraph, which is headed in our church Bibles, Treasures in Jars of Clay. Paul says this in verse 7. We have this treasure in jars of clay, to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We have this treasure. Who's the we in this sentence? Well, Paul himself and the people who work with him preaching the gospel, the other apostles, Paul's missionary team, men like Timothy and Silas and Luke. Paul says, we have a treasure. And what is the treasure? Well, he's told us in the previous verse. God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. God has given Paul and these others the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And that's the treasure they own. They know the glory of God. They've seen the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And now it's like a great light shining within them. Everywhere they go, they're carrying round with them the knowledge of God's glory. They've had it ever since they looked at Jesus Christ and saw God's glory in him. They've got that treasure hidden in their hearts. But they've not got it just to hoard away. Back in verse 4, Paul's talked about the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. The glory of Christ, the treasure that Paul's got in his heart, is now the gospel, the message that he wants to preach to others. And he does. In verse 5 he says, we proclaim Jesus Christ. So Paul and his friends have got the knowledge of Christ's glory in their hearts, and now they want to proclaim Jesus Christ to other people. They want to share their treasure with people everywhere. That's what true evangelism is all about. A man or a woman has looked at Jesus Christ, and they've seen how glorious, how wonderful he is. They've seen God's glory shining out in Jesus Christ. They know that they have to worship him. They have to obey him. They've got that knowledge of God's glory, Christ's glory, burning within them. It's a treasure they've got hidden in their own heart. And now they want to share it with other people. So they're going to their friends, their neighbours, the people they meet day by day, and they're telling those people about Jesus Christ. Because they want those people to see his glory too. They want those people to believe in him and to share their treasure. What do you need to become an evangelist? I don't mean what do you need in order to join some society and be sent out full time as a preacher. What do you need in order to tell other people what they need to hear? Well, the very first qualification is that you must have seen the glory of Christ yourself. You must have that knowledge of Christ's glory burning like a light in your heart. You've got to have that sense of how wonderful Jesus Christ is and how he shines with God's glory. And then if you've got that, you can go and tell other people how wonderful he is. You can share that treasure with them. So Paul says, we have that treasure. But he says we have it in jars of clay. And the jars of clay he's talking about are just himself and his colleagues. We are jars of clay. That's what Paul's saying. We've got this treasure hidden in our hearts to be shared with others, but we ourselves are just clay pots. What he means is that he and his colleagues are just ordinary. In Bible times, clay pots were the ordinary, everyday, not very valuable vessels that would be used. In the Old Testament, for example, in the book of Lamentations, chapter 4, verse 2, the precious sons of Zion, worth their weight in gold, are now regarded as clay pots, just the work of a potter's hands. Do you see the contrast? You have a gold or a silver vessel, it's worth a fortune. It has to be crafted so skillfully. And it's beautiful to look at. But a clay pot? Well, it can be produced by a potter in a very short time. And the materials are cheap, just earth. And people didn't think of clay pots as anything special. Paul, Timothy, Silas, Peter, John. These men had a wonderful treasure to share. They'd seen the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. But they themselves were just ordinary men with all sorts of physical and mental and psychological weaknesses. They were men who made mistakes. They were men who messed things up at times. They were men who struggled in all sorts of ways. They were all clay pot people. We said last week, God loves to put his treasure into clay pots. When he wants the knowledge of his glory to be taken into a town or a village or a school or an office, he'll usually put that treasure into a clay pot. He uses clay pots to transport his treasure. And he does it so that it'll be obvious that anything they achieve is down to him, not them. We've got this treasure in jars of clay, says Paul, to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. God doesn't want people to be looking at his servants and saying, wow, they're wonderful. That man, he's so clever, he's so strong, he's so able, he's so attractive. God wants people to look at his servants and to say, isn't God's power amazing? Isn't it amazing that he can use someone like that? I don't know how that man even survives, let alone achieves anything. It must be God's power, because it sure ain't coming from him. God deliberately puts his treasure into clay pots in order to make it obvious that whatever they achieve is down to him, not them. And Paul confesses that that's exactly the way it is with him. It's the point he's making in verses 8 and 9. If God weren't working in him, keeping him going, he couldn't possibly even survive. Clay pots aren't only cheap and ordinary, they're also easily broken. It's an ongoing miracle that a clay pot man like Paul has been kept in one piece all these years. The only reason Paul has kept going is because God's amazing power has been upholding him all along. In these two verses, verses 8 and 9, Paul lists out some of the things he's been through. Things that would have finished him off completely if God's power hadn't been holding him together. He lists four things. Number one, he's been afflicted in every way. Number two, he's been perplexed. Number three, he's been persecuted. Number four, he's been struck down. But the point he's making is that through all of those experiences, amazingly, he survived. He's been afflicted in every way, but not crushed. He's been perplexed, but not driven to despair. He's been persecuted, but not forsaken. He's been struck down, but he's not been destroyed. Let's look at those four things one at a time. Number one, he's been afflicted in every way. He has gone through so many painful experiences. He's been hurt again and again in every way imaginable. He's been hurt physically, he's been hurt emotionally. He's had long spells of illness. He has to live with a painful eye condition. There must have been something particularly ugly about it. He says in his letter to the Galatians that he came to them with this bodily ailment, and he says it was a real trial to you. He says you could have turned away from me in disgust. They didn't. In fact, he says, you'd have given me your own eyes if you could. Paul's got this ugly handicap. And he has to carry on working, studying, preaching with that constant handicap. Paul's been in and out of prison, living in foul conditions, chained up, locked away for years on end. Paul has many sleepless nights. He's always tired. Paul's gone hungry for days on end. Paul has been on the move constantly. He settles in one place for a few months, maybe a couple of years. And then just as he feels he's putting down roots, just as he feels he's got a circle of friends around him, he's moved on again. Paul's often terribly lonely. Paul knows he can never get married with the sort of work he's doing. That would just be impossible. Well, he's got a circle of friends. But so often those friends can't be with him. Because he's on the move so much, there are times when Paul is all on his own in a city. And he's got nobody. He's got nobody to talk to. He's got nobody to share with. He's got nobody to give him a smile or a hug or to cook a meal for him. And meanwhile, he's got so many people he's got to care for. So many people he's got to think about. And so many of the people whom Paul helps treat him so horribly. People turn against him without reason. People who owe him so much. People lie about him. You know, people were forging letters in his name and circulating them, trying to destroy his reputation. We'll talk in a minute about the persecutions he went through from non-Christians. But the way he was treated by people who were Christians or were supposed to be was just horrible at times. He'd spend years building up a church. He'd give himself to the people there relentlessly, and they would take it all for granted. And they wouldn't show a scrap of gratitude to him. And then along would come someone else. And they're all over the newcomer. And they're telling him that they owe him everything. When Paul says he's been afflicted in every way, he is not exaggerating. He just went through so much pain. Pain breaks people. People who are hurt and hurt and hurt and hurt again can come to a point where something snaps and they say, I can't take any more. I can't carry on like this. They're crushed. Some of them just sit and cry all day. Some of them become utterly bitter and cynical. Some of them turn to the bottle. Some of them kill themselves. Some of them just run away from everything. People can be crushed by loneliness or by rejection or by exhaustion or by physical pain. Well, Paul is experiencing all those things constantly. And yet, he's not being crushed. That's what he says. He says, we are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Somehow pain, the pain that's gone on all these years, hasn't broken him. Somehow he's kept going through it all. Yes, there are days when he sits down and cries. And there are times when he collapses through exhaustion. But then somehow he pulls himself back to his feet and he keeps going. Sometimes he feels he just wants to give up on people. But then when they knock on his door, he finds he's got the strength to open the door to them and smile. After all these years of pain, he's not bitter. He's not cynical. He's still believing. He's still trusting. He's still doing the work. He still loves God. And deep down, this is the most amazing thing of all, he's still contented. If you asked Paul, do you resent what God has put you through over these years? Do you wish you'd never been given this life, this job? Paul would say, no, it's been a privilege. It's been a privilege to serve Jesus Christ in this way. I wouldn't, if I had the opportunity, choose anything different. Paul is not crushed. And then secondly, he says, we've been perplexed. There have been so many situations where Paul hasn't known what to do. Situations that have been so complicated that he's just been bewildered. Different people all clamoring for his attention at the same time. Different priorities, all of which seem equally pressing. Should he concentrate on this? Or should he concentrate on that? Just what am I supposed to do? Decisions can be agonizing. You're put into situations sometimes where you can see that whatever you do could lead to disaster. Disaster for yourself, disaster for other people, disaster for a church. You're put in situations where there's a big decision that you've got to make and you don't have the information you need to make it, or you feel you don't. There are situations where you've got to deal with a particular person, but you can't be sure what's going on with them. Are they telling you the truth? Or are they lying to you? Or maybe, are they thinking that they're telling you the truth, but they're confused themselves? Are they acting out of malice, or are they just acting out of ignorance? If I do say such and such to this person, will it just antagonize him and drive him further away? But if I leave him alone, am I responsible for letting him drift even further? There are situations where people look to you for advice and you're terrified in case you give them the wrong advice. And you know that if you do give them the wrong advice, you could be held responsible for all the consequences. There are situations where you've got to take the lead. But you're frightened that your own biases could be distorting the situation, or you're thinking about the situation. I mean, you like so-and-so. You've known him for years. You want to be loyal to him. But would it be right to support him in this situation? Well, Paul's had to cope with all those types of situations. Decision-making is stress. And that stress can paralyze you. You can become like a rabbit caught in the headlights, unable to move, unable to do anything. Or you can just crack up. Lots of people do. When we talk about high-stress jobs, it doesn't usually mean jobs where you're just asked to work very long hours. It usually means a job where you're having to make decisions, important decisions, all the time. And lots of people crack under that pressure. Well, Paul says, I've been perplexed. Again and again, I've had to make decisions. I've just not known what to do. I've been put in situations again and again that are beyond my wisdom, beyond my capacity. But Paul says, I've not been driven to despair. I've not cracked up. In the end, I've managed to do something. I've not just been left staring into the headlights. I found that I can take one step forward at least. That's the only way of handling some complicated situations, isn't it? You can't think through the whole situation, much as you'd like to. You can't see a strategy that will resolve everything. And so you simply say, well, is there just one step that I can take now? Is there one right thing, one wise thing that I can do at this moment in time? You know, sometimes God puts you on a road that's got lots and lots of bends and twists in it. And you can't possibly guess what's round the next bend or the bend after that. And so you say, well, I don't need to. All I've got to do is keep going as far as this bend and then try to manoeuvre my way safely round this bend. And that's been Paul. With all the incredibly complicated, stressful situations he's had to handle, somehow he's never cracked up. He's never been paralysed. Somehow he's managed to take one step forward. He's managed to find something he can do in any situation. He's never been driven to that point of despair where you say, I give up. I can't do anything. I'm resigning. And then thirdly, Paul says, we've been persecuted. And hasn't he just? Later on in this letter, chapter 11, he's going to talk more about the way he's been persecuted. I mean, he compares his record with the record of some of the superstars who claim that they're servants of Christ. And he says, I've been through far greater labours, far more imprisonments, with countless beatings, often near death. 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes less one. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. In danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers. Paul must have felt that there were times when he had everyone against him. The Jewish establishment hated him. Five times Jewish leaders had sentenced him to be flogged nearly to death. 39 lashes each time. Now, one such beating was enough to kill many men. Paul went through it five times. But then the Gentile authorities had it in for him as well. Three times Roman magistrates sentenced him to be beaten with rods. And that sort of beating could smash your bones as well as rip off your flesh. And then there were the false brothers, Paul says. People who called themselves Christians but were pushing their false message. They thought of Paul as their number one enemy. He was in danger from them. And his own people, he says. I think he means his own relatives. There had been some of his relatives who thought he brought shame on the family. And he says, I was in danger from them. And then there were just the criminal types, the bandits, who were out to rob lonely travellers. He was in danger from them. It's horrible, you know, if you know you've got one enemy. Paul had enemies everywhere. There must have been times when he felt there's nobody I can trust because they're all out to get me. Everywhere he went, he knew he was a target. You know, the authorities in this country are just beginning to wake up to the problem of bullying in schools, whether physical bullying or cyberbullying. Teenage lad or girl has got one or a whole group of enemies harassing them on the school premises or online, and it blights their whole life. They can't sleep, they can't rest, they can't think of anything else. Some have been driven to suicide, haven't they? Obviously, with physical bullying, there's the stomach-churning fear of what the bully might do to them physically. But with a lot of bullying, it's not that. It's just the awareness that people hate you. And it's as if then that hatred is like a fog that's around you all the time. It just presses in on you from all sides, and you can never escape it. And of course, it's not only children who experience it. It can be at any stage in life. And that experience can leave you feeling utterly helpless and hopeless and suicidal. Well, Paul was hated. He was pursued relentlessly. He had enemies who were out to harm him everywhere he went. But he says, we're not forsaken. He says, even at the bleakest times, when I've had enemies all around me, I'm never alone. Because Christ's promise has been true. He's never left me nor forsaken me. I've never been in a position where he has just abandoned me and left me on my own with my enemies. I've never been brought to that point of terror to which my enemies would want to bring me. They've never managed to silence me. They've never managed to stop me from doing my work. Because at the darkest times, I've had Christ with me. After all the threats, after the bullying and the danger and the pain, Paul is still preaching the gospel. He's never been intimidated into silence. preaching the gospel to the Jews who hate him, to the Gentiles who obstruct him, to anyone who will listen. Persecuted, but not forsaken. And then fourthly, Paul says, I've been struck down. There have been those times, says Paul, when things have happened to me which have knocked me flat. Such devastating events that I felt I would never get back to my feet. He doesn't give us a list of those events, but you can find the traces of some of them in the book of Acts or the other epistles. Just to take one example, I think the crisis in Antioch that was caused by the Judaizers must have been one of those events. You remember Paul and Barnabas had been working together for years, building up the church in Antioch. It was the first church in the world where Jews and Gentiles worshipped together on an equal basis, with no division between them. And then suddenly these missionaries arrive from Jerusalem saying that they've been sent by James, that's Jesus' brother, and by John, who's Jesus' closest friend while he was here on earth. And these missionaries say that Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians mustn't eat together, especially at the Lord's table. Jews must keep themselves separate from unclean Gentiles. And lots of the Jewish people in that church were convinced by what these missionaries said. And they refused to sit down any longer with their Gentile brothers. The church is just ripped in half. And Barnabas, Paul's co-pastor, the man who mentored him when he was a young Christian, the man Paul looks up to as his great encourager, Barnabas decides he's got to go along with the line that the missionaries are taking. And even more horrifying, Simon Peter, who was visiting Antioch at the time, the man whom Jesus described as the rock, the man who first preached the gospel to Gentiles and brought them into the church, Simon Peter gave in. And he stopped eating with the Gentiles. In a matter of weeks, Paul could see everything he thought of as important being destroyed. He could see all his life's work being ruined. And all the people he had respected most betraying the cause. It was an utterly shattering blow. And then he hears that these missionaries, or another group linked with them, had gone on to the churches that he had planted in Galatia, and that those churches had gone over totally to the idea that Gentile Christians were unclean and needed to be circumcised and turned Jewish. It was total disaster. It must have knocked Paul totally off his feet. Now, I don't suppose that was the first shattering blow Paul ever received, and I know it wasn't the last. Paul was like a boxer who was just knocked down in the ring again and again and again. But Paul says, I've never been destroyed. Even those shattering blows have never finished me. Maybe the count's gone to 9 and some of those bouts. But somehow, lightweight Paul has struggled back to his feet to carry on the fight every time. There are those times in the life of a Christian when we're hit by sledgehammer blows. Blows that knock us right off our feet. Christian couple have a 9-year-old daughter. She's well. She's happy. She goes to school one day and has a fall in the playground. And she sinks into a coma. There's a hemorrhage in her brain. And she dies. How do you get up from a blow like that? A Christian woman finds that her husband's been having a secret affair for years. And for these months he's been making preparations to leave her. And he goes. Will that woman ever recover her faith, her contentment, her zeal for Christ? A teenage girl was swimming, diving with her friends. She breaks her neck. And she's told she's going to be paralyzed from the neck down for the rest of her life. Will she ever be able to say, "Praise the Lord," again? Paul experienced shattering blows. Any one of them should have ended his career in the ring. And yet somehow he's still fighting. He's still working, he's still praying, he's still proclaiming Christ, he's still praising, he's still singing. I talked last week about Spurgeon's conversion. Let's carry on. Let's talk a little bit more about Spurgeon. 6 years later, Spurgeon was the best known preacher in London. Thousands of people were thronging to hear him every week. Far, far more than the chapel could hold. So the church had to rent public buildings to hold the crowds who wanted to hear young Mr. Spurgeon. On Sunday, October the 19th, 1856, the church's evening meeting was to be held at the Surrey Gardens Music Hall. First time they'd met there. That hall would hold somewhere between 6 and 10,000 people. And it was crowded. Spurgeon gave out the opening hymn. It was sung. Scriptures were read, and Spurgeon gave brief comments as he read. And then he began to pray. And then as he was praying, suddenly, from points all around that great hall, there were shouts. Fire! Fire! The galleries are giving way! There's total panic. People began running towards the entrances. This is one man's description. The people in the galleries rushed down, precipitating themselves almost headlong over, or breaking down the balustrade of the stairs, killing some and fearfully wounding others. Those who fell through force or fainting were trampled underfoot. Several lives were lost in the melee. To make confusion worse confounded, it's also said that as fast as one portion of the multitude made their exit, others from without entered. There had been crowds waiting outside in the hope of still getting in. And as some rushed out, others were pressing their way in. The results of this dreadful panic are most calamitous and distressing. 7 lives have been sacrificed. Serious bodily injury inflicted upon a great number of persons. What was the reaction of the press? It was to blame Spurgeon, to accuse him of everything under the sun. Mr. Spurgeon is a preacher who hurls damnation at the heads of his sinful hearers. Mr. Spurgeon would take his hearers by the nose and bully them into religion. We would keep apart, widely apart, the theatre and the church. Above all, would we place in the hand of every right-thinking man a whip to scourge from society the authors of such vile blasphemies as on Sunday night above the cries of the dead and the dying, and louder than the wails of misery from the maimed and suffering resounded from the mouth of Spurgeon. What about Spurgeon himself? This is his wife's account. She heard a carriage stop at the gate. It was far too early for my husband to come home, and I wondered who my unexpected visitor could be. Presently, one of the deacons was ushered into the room, and I saw at once from his manner that something unusual had happened. I besought him to tell me all quickly, and he did so kindly and with much sympathy. He kneeled by the couch and prayed that we might have grace and strength to bear the terrible trial which had so suddenly come upon us. But how thankful I was when he went away. I wanted to be alone, that I might cry to God in this hour of darkness and death. When my beloved was brought home, he looked a wreck of his former self. An hour's agony of mind had changed his whole appearance and bearing. The night that ensued was one of weeping and wailing and indescribable sorrow. He refused to be comforted. I thought the morning would never break, and when it did come, it brought no relief. The Lord has mercifully blotted out from my mind most of the details of the time of grief which followed, when my beloved's anguish was so deep and violent that reason seemed to totter on her throne. And we sometimes feared he would never preach again. It was truly the valley of the shadow of death through which we then walked, and like poor Christian, we here sighed bitterly, for the pathway was so dark. Over the days that followed, he stayed in the home of one of the deacons in hope that the change in choir would be beneficial, that the Lord would be pleased to restore his mental equilibrium and unloose the bars which had kept his spirit in darkness. He went nearly insane during those days. And he thought this meant the end of his ministry. He thought that what had happened would cut short his usefulness and the great work of the gospel that was happening. The scandal, the horror of it, not to mention the actual deaths. And the people who had been left maimed, broken, by the event that he had organized. Struck down. Just a shattering blow. Again, it wasn't to be the last such shattering blow in his ministry. You know the story of the downgrade and the part his brother played in that. Oh, that broke him. And yet, the day came when Spurgeon did rise from the canvas where he'd been knocked, and he did begin to preach again, and his preaching continued to be powerful, and many, many thousands of people were brought to Christ through his preaching. Struck down, but not destroyed. How do we explain this? How do we explain what's going on in the life of Paul? What went on in the life of Spurgeon? How do we explain the afflicted but not crushed, perplexed but not driven to despair, persecuted but not forsaken, struck down but not destroyed? Paul explains it in the next verse, verse 10, where he says, "We are always carrying in the body the death of Jesus." People who see Paul afflicted in every way, persecuted, perplexed, struck down, what are they actually seeing? They're seeing the suffering, the dying of Jesus being shared by Paul. They're seeing Christ's suffering, Christ's death being shared in Paul's experience. Talked about this in chapter 1, the fact that those who are united with Jesus Christ share Christ's suffering, they share Christ's death. When people see Paul sobbing, when they see Paul cast down, when they see Paul on the floor, knocked flat, what they're seeing is Christ's suffering reproduced in him. And when they see Paul still living, still contented, still trusting, still moving forward. When they see Paul getting back on his feet after every devastating blow, what are they seeing? We're carrying around in the body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. They're seeing the life of Jesus, the power of Jesus, the spirit of Jesus working in Paul. That's Paul's secret. It's not him who lives, it's Christ who lives in him. It's not from Paul that there's this reservoir of strength. It's from Christ that this strength is given. He has Christ living within him. When you read verses 8 and 9, it may be that some of you can nod and say, yeah, I know what he's talking about. This is the cost of Christ's service. If you want to serve Jesus Christ, then this is the sort of life you must expect to live. These are the qualifications for Christ's service. These things don't disqualify Paul. The fact that he's afflicted and perplexed and persecuted and struck down, they're the qualifications that he has for serving Christ. And this is the promise that's given to Christ's servants, that they will not be crushed or driven to despair or forsaken or destroyed. But as the life of Christ is lived in them, they will press on in their service and for his glory.